Welcome to Rich Answers, a public affairs program of the Conference of Churches and a production of the 224 Ecospace, where changemakers work, create, and lead. For the last 18 years, I have served as the president and CEO of the Conference of Churches and the host of Rich Answers. Today, the tables will be turned as Reverend F. Lydell Brown, the Chief Operating Officer of the Conference of Churches, will interview me about my journey and a special art exhibit I've mounted called What is Black? Prayers and Portraits, which can be seen at the 224 Ecospace July 19th through September 18th. Welcome, Reverend F. Lydell Brown.
Thanks for this opportunity.
Glad to have you here, and I'm glad to be here with you.
There you go. So, let's jump right into some questions. Share with us the story of where you were born, who were your parents, and why God chose them for your life formation.
I was born in Torrington, Connecticut, Charlotte Hungerford Hospital, because my family lived in Norfolk, Connecticut, so they had to drive half an hour into Torrington for me to be born. But growing up, I was in Norfolk, which is a very small, old-fashioned New England town. And growing up in that place in the 60s and early 70s was a place sort of isolated and caught in a different time and era. But from a childhood standpoint, on one hand, it was magical to be in Norfolk, and on the other hand, it was very challenging because of the racism in that context. We're the only black family. It was very harsh in many ways. And yet for me as a child, in the middle of the harshness, there was a certain kind of magic about being there. I think one of my favorite places in Norfolk, even today, is the Norfolk Library. So as a child, I always liked to read and be in my own little world, even though the world that was around me was a bit challenging. So now that I am a grown person, I can look back and think more about why I was born to my father and my mother. My father was an activist. He really believed in social change, and so he had our family move to Norfolk. He was born and raised in Harlem, New York. He wanted us to have different opportunities. And he was an activist, so he believed that you have to show up in places, put your body on the line to make change happen, or really be the change. So by showing up in a place like Norfolk, we were the change. So at an early age, I learned how to navigate being in different spaces. My mother was a creative, so she was a pianist. She was classically trained. She did piano recitals, and then she served as the church organist at Workman Memorial Amy Zion Church in Torrington. And so she was very gifted and interested in the arts. So being born to an artist and activist, wow, it makes sense to me now that that's who I am today, being born to them, and that's what God's plan was.
So it shouts right out at me that you come from a very talented and very inspirational family. So share with the listeners your earliest memories as a child knowing God.
It's interesting because now people would look back and go, something was a little wrong. But I spent a lot of time in the crib. And so the crib was in my parents' bedroom, as can be the case. The baby's in the parents' room, and then there's the kids' rooms. And so I remember spending time in the crib in conversation with God. Must have been God, because I had a relationship with something outside myself, even standing up in the crib in my footsie pajamas. And I remember having thoughts about not thinking things were right. And it bothered me that my mother wasn't there when I wanted her to be there. And I was upset that they tried to constrain me in the crib. And I was talking to this other being, this other sense of being at the time. So I always had a sense of the divine, even as a child. Eventually, I got moved into the kids' room after my baby sister was born. She got the crib in the parents' room. Okay. And so then I was in the kids' room. And I remember having conversations then with the divine, even as a child. We were raised Roman Catholic, and I believed that the stories that were in the Bible really could come to life. I had one of those children's Bible books that you opened up and you had the different stories, like the story of Nebuchadnezzar and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and how they were in the fiery furnace. I remember this in my little children's book. And I remember seeing pictures of Jesus with the lambs and really having a sense of, you know, the Bible stories being true. And so as a child, I had my own theophany where I was in the bedroom and Jesus came into my bedroom when I was a little child and he was holding the sheep. He had black sheep underneath his arms.
Wow.
And there were little sheep that were with him. And so I remember Jesus handing me a black sheep. And so it was me having this relationship with God even as a little child. And growing up Catholic, again, we had a nun doll in the house and a priest doll. And this is back in the day when dolls had that kind of those plastic heads. And the nun doll, when you moved her habit, she didn't have hair. And I remember as a child, this bothered me. And really, I was more attached to being the priest than being the nun.
Okay.
So that, once again, was just my own knowledge of God and my own sort of experience. And even as a child, there were experiences I was having with God that I knew not to tell Father Sullivan or Sister Margaret. So I just didn't tell them what was going on in my spiritual life. So those are some of my earliest memories as a child with God.
Sure. So, you know, they always say hindsight is 20/20. So going back to something you just said, when you saw Jesus walk in your room with a little black sheep, what did that do for you, especially when you think about that right now, being that you grew up in a predominantly white community?
Well, now I see the symbolism. And of course, I didn't know any other Jesus but a white Jesus.
I
so
got you.
It was the white Jesus with the Aryan hair, with the wavy blonde hair coming in, handing me the black sheep. I just thought the sheep was beautiful. So I was just glad. I didn't know he was handing me. You know, so over the course of my journey, I understand now this relationship with, you know, black and white sheep. Mm-hmm. But as a child, I didn't think that the black sheep were bad. They were beautiful. And Jesus was giving them to me.
Wonderful. Wonderful. So how did God prepare you for ministry and what was your call?
In my childhood years growing up in Norfolk, it was a challenging place because of the environment itself. It was very much a hostile environment going to school because we were outside. I was an outsider, the little black girl. So I was being teased all the time. I was a chubby child. It was very painful to be in that kind of environment. But it taught me something about getting comfortable with myself. So I think that that was part of, you know, God's plan for me, that, you know, I can be in the midst of an environment with people, but God wanted me to be comfortable with me and God. And so that was my childhood upbringing in that sort of harsh environment. There was problems within my family, and always it was me and God. I always had God. And so I think my journey through childhood really continued to keep me close to God for myself. Mm-hmm. Now, my parents got divorced when I was 12 years old. On my 12th birthday, the divorce went through. And when the divorce happened, the family really shifted away from church. What I was told as a child was that we could no longer go to church because we were divorced. Looking back as an adult now, I doubt that they said we couldn't go to church. I just think that my mother decided she didn't want to go there anymore once she was a divorced woman, because those were very different times.
Sure.
And so I always had a relationship with church and the faith. And really that journey ultimately brought me back to the church. So I came back to faith as a 20-something in my 20s, and immediately I knew that's where I needed to be, and immediately my call to ministry seemed to really click in. I really felt reminded that God had always been talking to me and always wanted to use me to speak. And so immediately when I came back to church as a 20-something, I started seeing visions of myself at behind the pulpit preaching. At the time, I was at First Baptist Church in Hartford, and the pastor, Archbishop Bailey now, wasn't quite ready for women in ministry at that time. This was in the 80s. Not quite ready. And I did talk to my pastor about my call. And given who I was at the time as a 26-year-old, mm-hmm. now I can look through the lens and say, well, I didn't really present as somebody really being called to ministry. So I can understand why he was a little hesitant. He felt I needed to wait, but I knew that's what I wanted to do. So I was grateful that I started out at Hartford Seminary and started on the path and eventually accepted my call to ministry at Workman Amy Zion Church in Torrington. And that's where I started out preaching, and eventually I got sent back there as the pastor.
Wonderful, wonderful. So as you talk about Workman, what was your first appointment, as you just said, and how did it forecast your ministry?
Workman Memorial Church in Torrington was a church that was near death when I became the pastor, and it was a church where they needed change and they needed new life. So I went in there with the energy of a 30-year-old and gave it my all. The church went from about 7 people to, on the average Sunday, about 80 people that were there in service. We had over 300 people give their life to Christ in the 6 years that I was there as pastor. And it really became a church that was committed to young adults, committed to helping people restore their lives, get into recovery. It really became a church where it was all about building community and giving young adults a chance to be in leadership. And it was a church, because of the extreme poverty there of many of the people, we had to be all about social enterprise and the hustle to raise money together as a community to sustain the community. So that really became the key aspect of my ministry that carries on today. So we're at a magical time now, and I'm thankful, Reverend Brown, for this part of the interview. I guess we'll take a break at this point.
Great. Yes, we will. We'll be right back.
Here's a little song I wrote. You might want to sing it note for note. Don't worry, be happy. In every life we have some trouble. When you worry, you make it double. Don't worry, be happy. Don't worry, be happy now. Be happy. Don't worry, be happy. Don't worry, be happy. Don't worry, be happy. Ain't got no place to lay your head. Somebody came and took your bed. Don't worry, be happy. The landlord say your rent is late. He may have to litigate. Don't worry, be happy.
Look at me, I'm happy.
Don't worry, be happy.
Hey, I give you my phone number. When you're worried, call me. I'll make you happy.
Don't worry, be happy. Ain't got no cash, ain't got no style. Ain't got no girl to make you smile. But don't worry, be happy. Cause when you're worried, your face will frown, and that will bring everybody down. So don't worry, be happy. Don't worry, be happy now. Ooh,
don't worry, happy. Ooh, ooh, ooh. Don't worry, be happy. Ooh, 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 ooh. Don't worry. Ooh, 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 ooh. Be happy.
Thank you. time coming, but I know a change gonna come. Oh, yes, it will. It's been too hard living, but I'm afraid to die. 'Cause I don't know what's up there beyond the sky.
Answers. Today we are interviewing the president and CEO of the Conference of Churches, Reverend Dr. Shelley Best. And so let's get right back into the questions.
All right.
So you currently serve as the pastor of Redeemer's Church in Plainville, Connecticut. Describe that ministry.
So here I am now returning to ministry. So for the last 15 years or so, I had been serving primarily as the CEO of the Conference of Churches. Mm-hmm. I'm a Methodist, and so my bishop decided he wanted me to go back to pastoring. And so that's after not pastoring for many years, 17 years. And so the church is in Plainville, Connecticut, right on Whiting Street, which is near the downtown area of that community. Redeemer's Church is a church that's been around for over 100 years. Really strong family church, multi-generations, deep-rooted community, which is an amazing experience for me to encounter a community that's really sealed by tradition and family. So many of the members of that church are second and third generation members of the church.
Wow.
Where they were born and raised in Plainville in that church. And the stories that they can tell of their mothers and grandmothers and grandfathers serving there and building that community is really amazing. I've never encountered this kind of community of people before. So, of course, that has its strengths because of the commitment to family and connection. And it also has its challenges because it's such a family-oriented church, it may not always be easy for new people to come in. And so my role as pastor is to really do the work of building community, helping to open the door so all kinds of people can come in. And we really are growing the ministry that way. There's really a commitment to hospitality, to caring for other people, and to hold space for those who might come in, a real commitment to the arts as well, and definitely a commitment to healing ministry, which we're developing there in the church. So it's an opportunity for me to be involved as a pastor in many of the things that I care about and love, like self-care and yoga and contemplative prayer. And then how do we heal the things that have gone on in family? So that's part of the work that we do at Redeemers.
Wonderful. So you said there was approximately like 15 years in between your first appointment and then being appointed the pastor of Redeemers. So tell our listeners about the ministry here at the Conference of Churches, because you were doing that for the last 18, almost 19 years now at the Conference of Churches. And what is the Conference of Churches and the 224 EcoSpace?
So the Conference of Churches is a 118-year-old organization. I came on board 18 years ago as the CEO. And once again, as is the case in my ministry journey, it was an organization in need of shift and change. And the reality was me showing up as an African-American woman from a historically black denomination was a big change in itself. My just showing up was the change, because the organization prior to my appointment had only been run by men, white men from mainline denominations, Episcopalians, Lutherans, UCC leaders. That's a very different faith experience than being a part of the African Methodist Episcopal Zion Church.
Sure.
So I was changed as a woman, changed from a historically black denomination with a very different theological point of view. The Conference of Churches, having been run by people from mainline denominations, was comfortable in even its approach to fundraising, because it just sort of expected money to come, and it came, and they took care of things. When I came on board, because of my theological experience and upbringing in the black church context, money doesn't just come. You have to be about social enterprise, raising money, whether it's making sandwiches, frying chicken dinners, having concerts. You have to raise that money because you don't have an economic legacy. And so my mindset about ministry and resources was very different than what existed in the organization. And so we really had to do some exploring about new identity, new times, and how can we serve in a different way for the different times. And I know that one of the main things I really latched onto was this idea that we can't just give handouts to the poor. And that's sort of how poverty was addressed, where if people were poor, let's give that man a fish. We're just going to give out fish. We're going to give handouts of meals and clothes and maybe help with an electric bill. And so my mindset, because of my faith context, is don't just give out fish, teach people how to fish. And so how do we empower people so they don't have to keep coming back asking for more? How do we help people take care of themselves? And so out of that idea, we started to shift what was going on in the organization. Instead of being a traditional nonprofit living from grant to grant and donation to donation, we started to shift into the mindset of social enterprise. How do we find other streams of revenue to support this ministry so we're not living handout to handout and so dependent on getting money from the churches, where we want to be able to help churches and not just go to churches for handouts? And that really caused us to launch down the path of finding a way to develop our own social enterprise. And so we acquired a property, this called the 224 EcoSpace. We found a property that fit us. And now through the streams of revenue with the 224, we are able to support the core costs of the organization, the Conference of Churches, so we can do the ministry that really matters. And the 224 EcoSpace is a place where change makers work, create, and lead. And so it's a place where we help people employ themselves, many of whom are artists or small business startups. So we help people employ themselves. And this way, we help reduce poverty in this one little block that we're located in on Farmington Avenue. So we help to uplift the city and the community by giving people the power to take care of themselves. And most of the people that start businesses here tend to be social entrepreneurs, where they're not just about a business where they're helping just themselves. often the businesses that get started are things that help other people help other people. So it might be fitness, like Sister Jean Warren. She does Zumba. She helps people get fit, people that might not ordinarily be involved in exercise. Or Steve Hanke, who runs Island Reflections Dance Company. And so he helps young people get exposed to dance and drama, and he helps them get fit as well. Playhouse on Park, their educational program is here at the 224, and so they are a theater company, but they really have a commitment to message theater, so really changing people's minds by the kinds of theatrical productions that take place. So many of the people that are here are social entrepreneurs where they're really making a difference. So that's how the Conference of Churches has a ministry of supporting people, empowering people, and making a difference in the entire community.
Absolutely. So I want to throw a question at you. What do you see the biggest difference being when it comes to nonprofits today, as far as them being able to raise money or perform the business or do the things that their mission statement says that they're doing every day?
Without a doubt, times have changed, and I'm fortunate that I have been at the Conference of Churches, you know, knocking on 20 years, to be around long enough to be able to see how the change has happened in the course of the 20 years that I've been around. When I came on board, funding was much more available. Mm-hmm. Without a doubt, there was, you know, dollars that would be more experimental, where foundations and different organizations would fund new initiatives. Now, with the economic shift, we see that many of the nonprofits are confronted with only having funds for basic needs, as the majority of what's covered, food, clothing, shelter. And so getting funding now for experimental programs or things that are not like survival services, it's harder now. The other thing is government has changed. I did a lot of work around faith-based community development, where we would find dollars through government entities for faith-based organizations to make a difference in the community. Well, now that money is no longer readily available. So I think the big change is those who want to do good have to find the resources themselves to do the good. And that's why the door has opened to social enterprise, where many of us are finding ways of finding streams of revenue to fund the good work that we want to do.
Wonderful.
And that's necessary.
For sure. Which leads us right into our next question. So you have recently been selected as one of the 6 National Fellows for Do Good X, the Social Enterprise Accelerator Program in Atlanta. Talk about that a little bit.
And I'm really excited about this opportunity. Do Good X is a national initiative where they pick a class of fellows from around the country. That's a program of FTE, the Forum for Theological Exploration, which is a foundation out of Atlanta. That organization was best known for many years helping to fund the PhDs of scholars around the country. And so Do Good X is their way of supporting people that are doing the work of social enterprise, where we do good through these business ventures. So I was told about the program through my editor of a book that I'm working on. She was a fellow with the program. She suggested I apply.
Okay.
And I was hesitant about applying, and so I did. And then through a national search, I was one of the people that was selected to participate. What's a little scary to me or nervous to me is that the fellows that are selected nationally, many of them are much younger than I am, and they're like amazing young people really doing good in their 20s and 30s, and here I am in my 50s being selected. So it's like, wow, they still think I have value. And I know it's a terrible thing to say, but it's like, I'm not a 20-something, I'm a 50-something, but I appreciate being selected. That's really affirming me in my work of social enterprise. We didn't have the language of social enterprise when we started this kind of work.
Sure.
So for me, it's a chance to really be affirmed and also have some core knowledge that I didn't have before, so I can continue to do the work that I do here in the greater Hartford area. Mm-hmm. So I'm excited.
Absolutely. So there are a lot of people that look at your ministry and they see the things that you do. And so I heard someone say they called you a multifaceted minister. And so one of the things I want to ask you is, what part does art play in your ministry?
Well, I want to get into that a little bit more, so let's take a break, and then we'll talk after the break about her.
Okay.
have been listening to Rich Answers, a public affairs program of the Conference of Churches.
So you can use me.
I give myself.
I give myself to you. Give myself to you.
Well, can we say that as our prayer tonight? My life is not my own.
Back to Rich Answers. So we are continuing this very, very interesting interview with the president and CEO of the Conference of Churches, the Reverend Dr. Shelley Best. So the question that I want to continue to ask you is, as I said before, a lot of people look at your ministry and they call it multifaceted. And so I want to know, one of the parts is, what part does art play in your ministry?
And that's an interesting question, because art has really been emerging in this season of my ministry. So I started doing art when I was a student at Hartford Seminary. So this is back in probably 1988. Okay. I was a student of M.T. Winter at Hartford Seminary, and she is an amazing spiritual theologian, an artist. She's tremendously gifted. And so I had a class with her, and she said that we could choose anything we wanted to do as our final class project. So I love that about MT, you know, out of the box, whatever you want to do.
Mm-hmm.
And so immediately I had this thought, ooh, maybe I'll do a painting. And so that's what I decided to do. The only thing was, I had never painted before. So I had to figure out, how do you do a painting? So I went to an art store and I asked them, what's the difference between oil and acrylic? What do you choose? And acrylic was the choice because it dries faster. And I guess it's a little bit easier for an amateur. And so my first painting, it ended up being a triptych, which is a three-piece painting, which is three different canvases put together to make one piece.
Okay.
And it was a flying figure of a woman, and down below her were all these people with their hands lifted up. And so the image was of God as a woman flying in the air, and the people on the earth reaching up towards God. And that was the first piece that I did. So my paintings emerged out of my study theologically, and also my art has often been a spiritual practice for me. And so over the years, I have used art as a way for me to go on retreat in place where I'll get a canvas and I might spend a day painting. And I say to people, when I paint, I pray. So I will get a canvas. I will have a focal point that I'm praying about. And I might spend 3, 4, 6 hours painting. And painting is a very physical, spiritual practice for me because I will go into the space and literally I could paint for 6 hours straight, not eating, not going in another room, but staying in the zone of prayer on a subject that the painting reflects. And so, especially now that I'm pastoring, having time set aside to paint and pray has been my spiritual practice. It's been my self-care. It's been my way of retreat. And it's also been my way to work out some things that have been going on in the congregation. And so this upcoming exhibit is a collection of works that I've done in the course of the last year. And there are 53 pieces in the show. And when I look at it, I'm like, wow, how did that happen? Well, I've been praying a lot in the past year. And so that's really opened the door for me with art being a part of my ministry. It's a different way of expressing my ministry, the message, and the spirit. It's a way of capturing and expressing the spirit.
Wonderful. So talk about the exhibit. What is Black Prayers and Portraits?
Well, the way this exhibit came about, there is a photographer called Angelita Das who is out of Brazil. And she did a TED Talk, so you can look her up. And the talk she did was talking about skin color. And what she did was she photographed over 4,000 people around the world. And she photographed them with, you know, just their face, close up, head on, shoulders bare. And then she took their Pantone color. So by capturing what's going on in the center of a person's face, you get the general color of them. And then she put their color in the background and labeled it according to a Pantone color. In one of my former lives, I did graphic arts too. And so with the Pantone color, you just see the color of people. And when I saw her collection of photographs, this really captured me because the colors of humanity are amazing, the range of colors. And when I think about God and how God creates so much, has created everything, but God's attention to humanity and the diversity of colors without political attachment or attachment to geographic areas or economics or any of the other things that we often put as labels on people. But if we were just to take people as just the beauty of their color, just like a flower, just another flower. So when I saw her collection, it gave me that sense of just the beauty of humanity. It doesn't matter their religion, their status, whatever. It does not matter. It's just the beauty of a human creation. And so that became my focal point this year as I've been painting and praying to really develop a series of works. I do abstracts, and most of my paintings are geometrics. They're squares. That just seems to be the thing God has me just focus on. Part of why I like painting the squares is because when it comes to meditation, I can, you know, I design my canvases with the squares, and then I can just zone out. I don't have to think about the square. I don't think about shading, and I don't have to think about design. I can just be focused on color and focusing on those squares and just escape into that world and the flow of color on the canvas. And then as I've been praying, it's really been about humanity, about loving everybody, about not being attached to definitions of people, about being open to all kinds of people. So the question, what is black, has been sort of my centering point of this series, because what is black in America? And so when it comes to being black in America, you don't necessarily have to be the color black to be black.
True.
And actually, when it comes to being black in America, every single color in the continuum could be black if you identify as black. We know that some people are mixed race. Let's say your dad was African American and your mom was Japanese, and you may be fair complected and be kind of a yellow hue, but you're still black in America.
Absolutely.
Even though you look, you know, the shade of yellow or porcelain white, you still are black. And so that really was the riff for me and the prayer for me, because once a person identifies as black, their social location changes, they have different stresses, they may love people that are also black, and they know that their family members are at risk as black. And so that was sort of my launch. You could appear to be white, but if you tell people you're black, that has an impact on maybe the employment you might get. It has an impact on how you care about your cousins and your sisters and brothers. It has an impact on your worries. You know, I have friends that have mixed race relationships where, let's say, the wife is white, the husband's black, and she's white. She married a black man. Her kids appear to be black. Now she has to have black concerns. You know, one of my friends, white woman with black boys, and she's nervous all the time when her sons are driving around that they might be pulled over. She's a white woman, but she has black concerns. So this whole series is about what is black, what it means, and that's why it's prayers and portraits. So I have the works, which are the abstracts, which all represent either various kinds of altars or images. And then the prayers are specific prayers that have been written about issues around racial politics and people and what's going on in the world today, my heartfelt concerns when it comes to racial politics in America.
My God, my God. So I've gotten a chance to get a previewing in. I mean, I was blown away. But what is your desire for impact on this community from this exhibit?
Always, I want it to be a chance where I love bringing people into space where they feel something, and that's the experience that people have at the 224. They come into the space and they feel something. And one thing we didn't say before, the 224 is really an art space where it's a place where you have a different experience because of the color and some of the images and designs that are here. So with the exhibit, I want people to feel the same thing. Come into the show, feel something, and then read the prayers and pray along with me. And then I want it to be a space where we have some community conversations about race and politics and humanity and how we really need to come together to make a difference in the world that we're in. So my deepest hope is that this space and this exhibit might be an activity of healing for Hartford and maybe a seed for the world.
Okay. So how is God preparing you for your next phase of ministry?
Well, I think that as I'm growing older, I'm feeling older, and you start to see you have to do things differently. And so God is showing me how to work more from wisdom and love than brute force, because my body can't do the things that it did when it was 20. And so God is showing me how to work from wisdom and love more. And so I think that all of this is a way of God preparing me for the next season as I, you know, look at the reality that longevity is not promised and that every day matters, but you have to make a difference where you are with what you have to work with.
True. So when you say difference, what is the difference you would like to make in the world when it's all said and done?
I want it to be said that I touched a lot of people's lives. I left behind a legacy where I impacted their lives and made change happen. And that if you want to get a sense of who the Reverend Dr. Shelley Best was, take a look at the 224 Ecospace and see her legacy for itself.
Absolutely. So if someone wanted to experience your ministry, how would they find out more? What is your website? And when are your services?
All right. So you can find out more by looking at the 224.org. That's the website for the 224 Ecospace, the 224.org. Or you can look me up, ShelleyDBest.com. Or you can find the website for Redeemers 2020 for the Redeemers website. And you can also find me on Facebook, the Reverend Dr. Shelley Best on Facebook, and on Instagram you can find me.
Great. And so that wraps up our interview today with the Reverend Dr. Shelley Best. Usually she is the one interviewing, but today we had the distinct honor of coming in and asking questions and listening to her heart and her vision for herself and the 224. It has been great, and so thank you so much.
Thank you. I've been listening to Rich Answers, a public affairs program of the Conference of Churches and a production of the 224 Ecospace. Reach out to us and tell us what you think. Look for Rich Answers, the Conference of Churches, and me, Reverend Dr. Shelley Best, on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Like us, follow us, share us.